Hello, and welcome to episode 45 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Professor Jonathan Weiner of the Health Policy and Management Department at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. How are you doing today, Dr. Weiner?
Okay.
Excellent. So the first question I'd like to ask you is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
Well, at our School of Public Health, the Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health, we say saving and improving lives millions at a time. So, I mean, early in my career, there are a variety of alternatives, but that really appealed to me. So when we create new knowledge, when we provide service to a community, when we provide new tools, we're really trying to improve the health and welfare of, you know, either a community or a state or a country. So we try, not every day, but we try to accomplish that as often as we can through everything that we do.
Interesting. So when is it that you first felt called towards this or expressed an interest in this field? Was it, how did you get involved in healthcare and health policy in particular in the first place?
Well, it's and of course, usually it's a variety of events and junctions at the road. But there was one event that I do remember when I was a freshman at college. I took a seminar actually at a medical school at the University of Pennsylvania in Philly, and I thought I was interested in health or medicine. You know, what does an 18-year-old know? And the seasoned old professor, a family doctor, told the class that included me, a small seminar class, listen, if Philadelphia were an independent country, we'd be number one in doctors, number one in hospitals, number one in nurses, but 57th in infant mortality, 75th in longevity among minorities, and among the worst health of the poor neighborhoods. And I said, So somehow, you know, the issue of giving medicine to one person or providing care in a hospital, all laudable goals, was important, but we really needed to try to change the system. So ever since then, I've focused more on healthcare, health policy, and public health.
What are some things that you have done through the course of your career to change that system? What exactly does one do to improve the state of infant mortality if Philadelphia were a country? Even in Baltimore City, where you're located, there's a fairly significant disparity between life expectancy in the largely white and wealthy neighborhood of Guilford and life expectancy in West Baltimore's largely African-American communities. What are you specifically doing, or what have you ever done to really try to address those public health challenges that you first became inspired by?
Well, what you say is true, and it's not just Baltimore. It's pretty much every city in the country, red state, blue state. You know, we have at the same time, some say the best medical care system in the world, but most believe that our health care system, our public health system, is one of the worst of any developed high-income country. Some rank it at 30th or 40th. So there's obviously no magic bullet, but I think trying to integrate 95% of all the health dollars really goes into medicine. So I'm sitting at my office here at the Johns Hopkins Public Health School, sitting looking at the hospital, the Johns Hopkins Hospital, one of the best hospitals in the country. You know, should you or I or any of your listeners need medical care, it's a great place to go. However, looking out the other window, I see a community, just as you say, one of the poorest, one of the most challenged. So bridging, to answer your question, you know, bridging medical care with public health, acknowledging that it's not just about medical care and clinical, but also about social well-being, a job, housing, good food. And so that's sort of the premise. But specifically, you know, how can I have an impact? Well, obviously teaching the next generation of students, master students, doctoral students, they'll go out and have a change. Service, we work with city, state, federal, and actually international, and the development of tools. we have developed a series of tools, heavily digital tools, electronic tools that are now in use in many countries, and they're used to try in a small way and sometimes a big way to appropriately target healthcare services and to shift the issue to health, not just providing medical care when someone is sick.
Now, you actually designed a tool called ACG that is used to actually achieve the same ends that you were just speaking of, which is identify a high-risk population. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to develop that tool, what it does, and the significance of it?
Well, I was referring to that and a variety of other things, but I and my colleagues here at the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins were among the first to take digital data. And in our system, for better or for worse, we have much better data for paying bills of doctors and hospitals than we do for public health or medicine, for that matter, although, as we'll talk about later, it has been a huge advance in electronic medical records. But taking the information that doctors and hospitals have and collect, we tried to look at patterns among large populations, patterns in inner city areas, patterns in rural areas, to try to understand the types of conditions people have. You know, as most doctors and other clinicians appreciate, when a patient walks in the door, they may or may not be the patient in greatest need, and it sometimes is too late. So our so-called Johns Hopkins ACGs, originally that was ambulatory care groups, now it's just ACGs, adjusted clinical groups, is used about 150 million people in about 25 countries. It's heavily used here in Maryland for Medicaid and other purposes and 20 other Medicaid programs. And what it does is it looks at the diagnoses that doctors and nurses assign. It looks at what medications we're on, and it tries to appropriately target resources, like sending a special nurse in to people in trouble. So it's that's the 3-minute version of what ACGs are.
So it identifies a high-risk population, which for our listeners, high-risk would be somebody who's likely to get sick and want to seek medical care, or for whom earlier intervention would both improve health outcomes and reduce costs. And you identify those populations and target them for clinical intervention or public health intervention, and somehow maybe send a case manager over to their house or call them, get them for a screening or something, and therefore help improve public health for that one individual. Because isn't it true that a small proportion of the population accounts for a significant proportion of the whole cost incurred by the entire population?
Yes, that's true. Our healthcare system, one of the least efficient in the world, and, you know, I think that the next couple years with President Trump, the repeal and replace, hopefully it's repeal and modify, but the need to ensure some sort of adequate healthcare while retaining costs, this is part of the solution as well. Someone who is the sickest of the sick may cost $200,000 for intensive care unit ICU, when in fact that's not really the most efficient. You know, if we send a nurse into their house to help them with their congestive heart failure or their diabetes, you know, two advanced diseases, and if we can keep them out of the ICU by helping them with their home needs or helping them with a visit to their primary care doctor, and that's what our ACG. Sometimes it's called a predictive modeling or risk identification method. So in other words, we look at the digital data, we look at all the millions of pieces of information in a state or in a region, and we try to identify those people at the highest risk and who are also the most expensive too.
So for our listeners, ICU is an intensive care unit, and basically what Dr. Weiner is saying is that there are multiple levels of care, and a higher level of care is more expensive than a lower level of care. For example, an intensive care unit or an emergency department is more expensive to deliver care to an individual who, is more expensive to deliver care than, say, a step-down unit, which is less intensive than an intensive care unit, or an outpatient, which means you go in and you go out in the same day, or having a home visit. Dr. Weiner, why is it that certain levels of care are less expensive than others? And then segueing from there, a lot of people think just intuitively, as you mentioned earlier, we have probably the best medical care in the world. And how do you differentiate that from healthcare? A lot of people say, why do the sheikhs of Saudi Arabia come to the United States for healthcare when they're dying if we're so terrible after all? So, and that may lead into a conversation on need-based rationing, but basically, why are different levels of care, why do they vary in price and cost? And then two, how you respond to somebody who says, but, you know, all the wealthiest, most powerful people come to the United States for their health care.
Well, you've asked a lot of good and challenging questions, so let me unpack it a bit and pick a few. So first of all, you know, our medical care system is very fee-for-service oriented, so everything a doctor hospital does, they usually get paid a separate bill, and the more complex, the more the payment. And, you know, that at the same time is has led to very positive things of our healthcare system. Yes, the sheikhs or other people from around the world for very intensive type of services, advanced cancer, advanced surgery, that type of care we do well. But primary care, that is your general practitioner, family practitioner, pediatrician, or even a nurse practitioner, not medical care at all, but really health, obesity, substance abuse, poor nutrition, smoking are really far more of a greater impact than our medical care system. And, you know, we can do better. It's challenging. But in some countries, not that other countries are perfect, but in some countries there is a better integration of all levels of care. And by that I don't mean just medical care, but things that improve a person's life. Obviously, environment and air and exercise are really extremely important, you know, for diabetes and other conditions, obesity. And if a person is treated in that way, they'll never end up in the intensive care unit. Yes, there are many positive things about our medical care system. But in Maryland and in other places, there is a movement, whether or not people call it accountable care, ACOs, or certain types of health maintenance organizations, HMOs. And in Maryland, we have something called an all-payer, sometimes called global budget system, moving away from fee-for-service, that the hospitals are getting a flat rate, and they're being judged both on the quality of care that they provide to people and are they leading to a healthy community. So there are many innovative approaches, many that actually relate to the market. So I do hope that President Trump maintains some of those innovations that will increase health.
So it sounds like the way you pay for care changes incentives for how care is delivered. So it sounds like a fee-for-service, which incentivizes volume, where every single service I as a physician or a hospital provide to you, the patient, I get paid for, leads to higher volume of care versus the global budget that you speak of is where I will get X amount of money per month, per member per month. The term is called capitated budget, and then I take risk, meaning I get the money. And if I can keep them healthy for less than that amount of money, then I keep the profit. But if I need to spend more than that amount of money to keep my patients healthy, then I actually incur a loss and am responsible for their care. So America saw this a little bit in the 1980s and 90s, and we had something called a managed care backlash. Could you explain a little bit why the effects of the Affordable Care Act and current adventures in shifting towards global payments differ from our experiments, largely considered failed experiments in the managed care backlash of the 80s and 90s.
Well, again, you have a lot of good points there, and I'll try to address as many as I can. So, yes, no system is perfect. Fee-for-service means the doctor or hospital does more and more. Sometimes that's good. Sometimes if the patient doesn't need it, that's bad. A flat capitation or global budget where the doctor hospital gets a flat amount means, first of all, no ethical doctor is not going to give care when it's needed, and no ethical doctor is going to give care when it's absolutely not needed. It's in the gray area. So back to the capitation and budgeting. Yeah, it's true that under such a system, they're less likely to give care if it's not needed. Frankly, if it was me, I'd prefer not to have the surgery. But, we all also, managed care gets a bad rap. Yes, there are some unethical health insurance and managed care organizations, and there are unethical doctors, but not many. So I think we really need to, design a system, with checks and balances. And in the policy environment, again, I'm a professor of health policy and management. We've been talking about, in a public health school, we've been talking about economics. I want to come back to that because the real interest is how to impact society. But in the policy environment, you know, I talk a lot about policy overshoot. We don't like left, we go right. We don't like right, we go left. You know, we don't like fee-for-service, we go capitation. We don't like capitation, we go fee-for-service, when the truth is really something in balance in between. Again, just a reminder, the theme of your podcast, all of these medical care issues, you know, while true and interesting, is really was my realization that if we're going to truly have an impact and truly help society, the big picture, yes, we need good doctors and hospitals, but we need a system that ties together, and it needs to look at, you know, not only the individual, but also the community, you know, and the welfare, which is a bad word nowadays, but the social welfare, meaning the well-being of a community, and medical economics and medical organization is really intrinsic to public health and health and welfare.
So, and you mentioned that socioeconomic determinants of health and behavioral determinants of health actually have a much greater impact on health than does the type and amount of care that one receives. To what extent, you know, then why not just focus on education and housing and nutrition and improving the social safety net and really addressing a root cause of negative healthcare outcomes, which is poverty? To what extent are you or are your colleagues addressing those issues through your roles? And so let's leave it at that.
Yeah, again, another challenging and you know, accurate observation. Well, you know, I think, you know, why is it that all of us, you and me included, don't always do everything as healthy as we would like? And why is it that, you know, not everybody can afford to live in a healthy neighborhood or afford to go to the gym? And why is it that everyone doesn't have, you know, a good job or a stable family? There are a lot of reasons for that. We can't lay that all to the, you know, the responsibility of the medical care system or even, you know, organized societal programs, per se. However, they should be addressed to the extent we can. We should all contribute to that. I mean, there's certain entities, social-minded entities, that, you know, whether or not it's a Native American organization or a community activist group or a consumer cooperative healthcare system, we tried that for a while. They're doing exactly what you say. You know, they're trying to take a proportion of their healthcare dollars and using it, you know, to help someone, fix their house or help them get a job. I remember early in my career, I visited the National Health Service in the UK, specifically Wales, where coal miners were working, and they lost their jobs. And I went to the family doctor's clinic, and he had decided to take a third of his clinic and turn it over to a job placement center rather than give medical care. And I said, why are you doing that? Because he's learned that when people get a job, they're half again healthier, and that was his responsibility. That would be a tough thing for us to do in this country. So I do think that we should acknowledge it, but, you know, I don't want to be too preachy about that's the answer and that's all we should do. It's really, you know, part of how we look at it. And my job as a professor of public health is to remind both my medical colleagues as well as, government colleagues that it's not just about a health insurance card or a Medicare card. It's really about these bigger issues.
So I'd like to shift the conversation a little bit back to you being a professor and your students. Can you talk a little bit about the impact that you have had on your students from any feedback you may have gotten over the years and what's driving your students and what's driving you and how the two interplay together?
Well, I've been at this a long time, and you know, one thing that makes being a professor at Johns Hopkins exciting is the students. We have, I think, something like 3,000 public health students at any one time from all over the world, master's level, doctoral level. The school focuses very much globally, although health policy management, we focus more on the U.S. and other high-income countries. I mean, the whole topic of global health and needs in poor countries is a whole other topic for a podcast where the needs are even greater than in our country. But it's, you know, through you know, teaching 200 students a year in various classes, both online all over the world and on site here in East Baltimore, helping people develop tools, helping them be lifelong learners. Obviously, you know, learning about the current ACA or the current president, that's important. But some of us have been at this for many presidents and many different health reforms. So I think understanding the bigger picture is important and allowing them to have an impact. And so I feel good about that. And, yeah, I like it when my course gets good ratings and people like what's, you know, I'm presenting them. But to be honest, three times more important than that is if somebody 3 years, 5 years down the road says, you know, Professor Weiner or Jonathan, you know, I'm not so sure I really appreciate your class when I took it. You know, you're an okay lecturer, you know, not the best lecturer in the whole school. But, you know, what I learned really allowed me to have an impact in my community. And when I developed this new program, it's now better because of what I learned with you. So that's what really makes me smile. And it happens, you know, a couple dozen times a year. And, you know, that keeps me going on a bad day. So that's a little vignette.
I mean, that's pretty nice to feel as though you're really having an impact and you see your own research and your own work having an impact, but then to know that you're in the classroom and you're seeing students who later are doing their own research and their own programs and their own implementation, and they're having an impact based on how you affected them. How does that make you feel when you receive that feedback?
Well, it's good. We all have bad days and good days. And, you know, again, like I said, sometimes people like my courses when they're taking them. But it's I'm not teaching it just to get good ratings. I'm teaching it as an extension of my goal of making our world a little bit of a better place, when we're done with it. And of course that's challenging. So, and the students, here at Johns Hopkins are pretty special, as I think you know. And, so we're lucky that they're likely to go have an impact themselves. And, you know, students are in all kinds of places, government agencies, corporate agencies, universities. Our students, I have a student who was the number one analyst on Obamacare. I have a student that's the number one Republican analyst who worked with McCain. I think we'll see him in the Trump administration. So, you know, it's not really a political issue. It's an issue of helping people.
Interesting. So on the topic of helping people and the acknowledgement that we're nearing the end of the podcast, I'd like to ask you to reflect upon your years in health policy as a professor, as a researcher, frankly, as a businessman who developed, you know, a very profitable business product that we spoke of earlier in this podcast, the ACG. What is it? You know, I'm sure you've had late nights and you've worked, outside of 9 to 5 hours. What is it that drives you? Why have you always been motivated to, as you say, save lives millions at a time? What is it that really speaks to you that gets you going every morning?
Well, first of all, no 2 days are alike. And the world offers us opportunities, in my case, I've been spending a lot of time increasingly using the big data, electronic medical records, public health data, social data. So the world offers me data, and the world offers me fantastic colleagues and students. Can I take it and pull it all together and make things a little bit better at the end of the day or the end of the week than they were at the beginning? And, yeah, we have to bring in revenue. No, as our dean is fond of saying, no margin, no mission. But, you know, and not to put down anyone that goes to business. There are a lot of businesses that do good. But to be able to, leave the world a better place and take the disorder and make it more orderly, that gets us through the day, through the week here. And there are tough times, budget cuts, challenges, as with any responsibility. So that's just sort of a little view.
So Professor Jonathan Weiner is someone who incrementally tries to make the world a little bit better as best he can. He has a global impact, and sometimes the immediate effects of his work can be somewhat removed from actually seeing a direct effect on an individual. But he does have feedback from students, and that does have a real direct impact. And then he sees the indirect impact of his students' work, of his work, of really kind of having a global sense of what healthcare is doing and how we can make populations healthier over time. And for Jonathan, it's rewarding to just know that each and every week, every day, he's just done a little bit within his power to try to improve the state of the world. This has been episode 45 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.